Stardate 98026.25. Welcome back to Star Trek Discovery Pod, the number one podcast about a better future. My name is Mike Moody. With me on the view screen is
Mariah Gossett,
Clyde Haynes,
and Grant Davis.
So, first up, I want to say that we are incredibly lucky and privileged to be able to gather and escape into the fantastic and aspirational Star Trek multiverse today, as we share our love for the franchise with you, our listeners, our community, our friends. We hope our little pod provides you with some entertainment and levity this week as we dive into a wonderful, celebrated episode of Trek and more on today's pod. But now today at the top, I would like to sincerely acknowledge the names and lives of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, and so many others, far too many, by saying that everyone here at the pod acknowledges that Black lives matter. We acknowledge the urgent importance of empathy, compassion, care, justice, and positive action for all Black lives. Because a state-sanctioned systematic racism and violence against Black people in America is a crisis that urgently must be addressed. And we accept the responsibility of addressing it within our peer groups, families, and community, and with you, our listeners. And we acknowledge that these conversations are only the beginning of the path we must walk to effect true and lasting change.
Yeah, and I just, I wanted to say I also acknowledge the privilege and appreciate that we do have this platform, and I'm glad we're using it responsibly today to hopefully inspire other people to have conversations in their home and with their community about racial justice and police brutality. I know there's been a flood of voices into this movement, and I would just really encourage people to continue to specifically listen to Black community organizers and to find ways to continue their own learning journey. I'm happy to help, sincerely happy to help if people have questions about books, articles, or other resources to help them get started on how to work to be actively anti-racist. And it's important to have these conversations, and I understand it can be very scary to get started, but it's more important to start and to have good intentions than it is to always be perfect. And listening and learning and doing what is accessible to you is the best place to get started. So again, I'd really encourage people to reach out to me if you have questions, and I'm really glad we can use something like Star Trek to show us what the future can look like. But we need to understand that it's made in a contemporary society, and we have to do the work now if that's what we want the future to look like. So with all that said, I know we announced it on Twitter and on our Instagram, but we will be using all of the Patreon funds that we gather in June, as well as us making individual contributions to a fund to donate to the Black Lives Matter Global Fund, our local Austin Justice Coalition, and the Austin-based 401 Bailout Fund. These local organizations do really great work, and I'm really glad we can support them any way we can. If you'd like to just make your own individual contribution, we'll put links in the show notes. But if you'd like to contribute to our pool for some larger donations, you can go to donate.startrekpod.co and help us make a nice contribution at the end of this month. So there'll be more information in the show notes. And again, please reach out to me. I'm at Mariah Gossett on all social media platforms, and I'm happy to discuss anything with you.
So for me, and if you're listening, this is Clyde. This has been a truly challenging week and a half. And I've had a number of different emotions, as many of you have had. From numbness to shock to anger to hopelessness, to not knowing what my emotions are. And one of the things that has been truly uplifting in a time where there doesn't seem to be anything worth pointing to has been this community. My co-hosts, who have made me feel as a Black man in particular, seen and known, which I can't tell you how important that is. And this community is an interesting one because we are a community of people who love Star Trek. We talk about what the Federation values, the ethos, the mission, what it means to be in the Federation, a world that is truly aspirational. And so for us as a community to love that world, and like Mariah said, and then be faced with the reality that we're so far from that world, but to know that there are people in here who are still striving to get there is important. And so I'd like to encourage you, kind of regardless of what your race or background is, to get to know people, especially people of color, to use your voice to stop injustice anywhere and everywhere. And I say that because I truly believe that our differences are important, but they're not big enough for us to hate anyone. Our differences allow us to have a different flavor and background and keep life interesting, but we shouldn't hate. And the best way to do that is to get to know people who aren't like you so that you can truly see that they're just like you, even though they're not.
Thank you, Claude.
Yeah, for my part, I want to just echo all the sentiments that you three have already expressed and agree with you that it's been difficult. It's been frustrating, very, very upsetting, heartbreaking. And there've been moments, glimmers where you see the positivity, the bright side of humanity, and just wanting to kind of grasp onto those moments. I think it's important that we're dedicating this episode of Star Trek to talking about the more aspirational aspects of Trek, of the future. And I've been impressed with coming into the world of Trek, how I've been embraced by the community. I've done a lot of different geeky projects. I've been exposed to how people can be territorial of certain projects. And I think there's actually a considerable amount of, what do you call it? Stereotyping of the Trekkie, that it is maybe territorial as well, but that has not been my experience. It's been very open arms, very embracing, and very positive. And the fact that we can explore these important issues through that lens, I find rewarding, and I've really appreciated getting to engage with this audience and see the outpouring of love in this difficult time and people not shying away from the difficult conversations. I know behind the scenes, I was talking with you guys about recognizing the importance for me of knowing that I need to take time to listen to other voices. And, you know, on a podcast like this, I'm very used to just running my mouth and talking and sometimes rudely talking over people. And that's not necessarily intentional so much as it's a learned trait of doing this for a while. Also, yeah, you know, taking the time to shut up, Grant, and listen to what other people have to say, not just in the context of podcasting, but just like in society, I think has been very valuable for me. But also, not not being afraid to engage in the conversation, not trying to avoid talking about racism. I saw this graphic, which I shared with you guys, and said, don't avoid talking about racism because of a fear of getting it wrong, which resonated with me. So it's like, yeah, this conversation has to happen, and there's no learning, there's no growth if you shut down and don't engage. So with that said, I'm excited to engage with y'all, which is a Trek reference as well. But I know we're going to get into talking about the episode and everything, but before we did move on to that, I also want to acknowledge that this week we were going to be discussing listener pitches for new ideas for Star Trek shows. And we've obviously put that off. We're going to be following up with it either next week or the following week. And we want to thank you guys so much for all of the amazing pitches you guys have already sent. It's a further reflection of what passion this show drives and instills in its fans. And it's really encouraging to see how you guys have poured your heart into these fantastic ideas for these pitches. And the creativity is exciting. So we are excited to do right by y'all. When we revisit that topic.
Grant, I'm so happy you acknowledge the community around our podcast and around Star Trek, because growing up, Star Trek was always a home for me. It was a home where individuality was always celebrated, when maybe it wasn't always celebrated in my actual home or where I grew up. And that was always important to me. And it's just, I don't have the words to say how grateful I am that we have this community of people listening to our show, watching our live streams, engaging with us in the Slack. And, you know, they're all responding to our show because we come to it as ourselves. There's no pretense. We're here to celebrate Star Trek in our own special way. And we all have different perspectives about it. And I think people just respond to that, and I think that's a beautiful thing. And I want to thank everybody for listening and supporting us over the past, like, couple years. We've been doing this for years. It just seems like yesterday. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And guys, everything you said was amazing and beautiful. Thank you so much. I also want to mention there is an anti-racism resources list floating around the internet that has been really helpful to me. It includes a number of articles and book and movie recommendations and fundraisers and more important resources to check out during this time. I really want to encourage everybody to read that. We'll link to it in the show notes. And real quick, I want to call out one article just to tell you how impactful this can be, or searching out these types of things can be. There was one article I read that I found very relevant and helpful to me, was from Teen Vogue, which published, if you don't know, publishes really
excellent
cultural
journalism
pieces. Yeah. And it's called How Latinx People Can Fight Anti-Black Racism. And
wow.
I know some of the listening audience are part of the Latinx community. And this article is very helpful to me, since it includes some information of the role of white presenting Latinx people like me when trying to spread the message of anti-racism, especially in our families and beyond. So that Google Doc is super helpful. There's just a spectrum of information in it for so many people, and it's a very helpful resource. I really encourage everyone listening to check it out, and it's linked at the show notes below. All right. So let's dive into it. I thought this week might be an appropriate time to discuss the great Deep Space Nine episode, Far Beyond the Stars, as sort of a springboard for maybe a broader discussion about the progressive social and racial justice stories of Star Trek and the positivity of Trek. So it's the 13th episode of DS9's sixth season. The show ran for 7 seasons, so this came pretty late in the series. First aired February 11th, 1998. And was directed by Avery Brooks, written by Ira Steven Behr, Hans Beamer, and story by Mart Scott Zickrey. And if I could, I just want to talk about what this episode means to me real quick at the top. You know, Star Trek has been telling political stories and confronting social issues like racism since the 60s, when the original series premiered on TV. That's a fact. There are some people out there who falsely claim that Trek was never socially conscious or political, but that's bullshit. We know that with Discovery premiering, with Sonequa Martin-Green as the lead of the show and the show's themes of social justice and the fact that it includes a more diverse cast, there's been some ridiculous and hateful attacks from people pushing back on Discovery and New Trek, trashing the show simply because it features people of color and diverse viewpoints. I think this is relevant. In 2017, when Discovery premiered, Sonequa Martin-Green was asked about this hateful troll response to her as the lead of the show and the show. And what she said, I think it's just super relevant to what we're going to discuss today. So I just want to read it real quick. She said, "I would encourage them," the trolls, "to key into the essence and spirit of Star Trek that has made it the legacy it is. And that's looking across the way to the person sitting in front of you and realizing you are the same, that they are not separate from you, and we are all one. That's something Star Trek has always upheld. And I completely believe that's why it's been a mainstay in society, in the hearts of so many people for so many decades. I would encourage them to look past their opinions and social conditioning and key into what we're doing here, which is telling a story about humanity that will hopefully bring us all together." And Clyde, this echoes what you were saying earlier. That's it. That is the essence of Trek for me. And those are my favorite episodes that truly put this idea to the forefront. And I really think this episode, Far Beyond the Stars, we're going to talk about here, really does that. I have a lot to say about this episode. I know for some of you, it might be the first time you watch this episode, but I am just really interested to hear, just to get the conversation started, what you thought about the episode. So if it's appropriate, I'm going to ask for your hot freaks.
Hot freaks!
Yeah! Who wants to go first?
I can go. So I haven't watched a ton of Deep Space Nine yet, but I have to say, I think this episode might be my gateway into Deep Space Nine, because I thought it was very compelling. I thought the writing was really great. I also just thought the acting, like the character of Benjamin Sisko, was so strong and amazing to watch in this episode. Like that, I think the scene for me that really does it is at the very end when he finds out that the magazine has been pulped and he just finally lets it all go. It was riveting. It was like, I had a good cry this morning watching it. So it was like, you know, very cathartic. And it was like every emotion that you could feel building up throughout this episode. And then, you know, with everything going on right now, I was like, oh, this is it. This is the reaction of the world right now. Like, I can feel every ounce of every piece of anger and frustration from this performance. It was really great. And I actually really liked seeing all of the characters, too, out of their alien makeup. Like, I had to do so many double takes because I could hearing Worf and then seeing Worf. And I was like, I'm so confused right now.
He looks so different. Yeah.
Who is this attractive baseball player not covered in makeup? So that was, anyway, I just think it was very clever. I thought it was really well done. I, you know, coming into it, I was like, is he dreaming? Is he in a trance? What's happening? And then I did a little reading after and I was like, oh, this is like a thing. He has like visions from prophets. And I was like, well, now I got to know about these visions and prophets. So I might be hooked into Deep Space Nine now. So this is happening.
Yay.
But yeah, I think my hot freak is I really enjoyed it. I thought it was very beautifully directed and acted. And I thought it was a fun change of pace from normal sci-fi Trek. And instead of talking about, I think, some of the roots of science fiction were these like short story magazines and how we have since grown from that representation of sci-fi to what we get now in shows like Deep Space Nine and Discovery.
Cool. Do we want to keep the same order? Just Clyde?
Sure, I'll jump in. I love this episode. A little different from Mariah because I watched Deep Space Nine. And I remember when it's kind of sort of spun off or was introduced, you know, during the TNG run. And it was one of those things that it was a little bit shocking to see that not only was the principal kind of, I don't want to say captain, but the principal character was a black man, but it was all the other stuff, right? And you got to see that in this episode in the fact that it wasn't just a solo black person, right? So when you think about Discovery, for instance, we see Sonequa Martin-Green, but that's all we see. In DS9, we see Sisko, we see his son, we see the love interest, we see his father. Like, there is a family unit there, and we got all of that in this episode. And in those lines, you got to see kind of going back in time. Not only did you get to see the journey of Benny, right? But you got to see these other people around him, particularly like his love interest and, you know, how what it felt like when, you know, the person who wasn't his son but actually was his son was killed. You got to see those emotions, and those really jumped off the screen to me. And it's one of those things. I love the fact that it was directed also by Avery Brooks. And he's always been a very interesting character to me because he's different. Like, when you see him act, he's got these live theater chops that are absolutely evident and sometimes can be a little too interesting because no one else around him has those chops, right?
Oh,
well, I'm not saying they don't, but not like him. Like, he shows up on the stage and it's like, if I'm sitting in the mezzanine, I still feel his presence.
Yeah.
And so, Mariah, I completely agree. Like, it was good all the way through, but the end, like, it meant everything. And so to me, I look and go, this is an episode as a very interesting bottle episode that needs to be archived in history. Because I think there's so much there, and I agree. Not only was it fascinating to see the characters out of makeup, but the nuances in their behavior that were different from some of their characters was also amazing. Like, it was just really well done. And I think this is one of those things that, you know, I look and go, this will be something that I share with my children, right? This will be an episode that we watch and we talk about and we discuss. So my hot freak is just, as a person who's not always a huge fan of bottle episodes, this is on my list of great bottle episodes, and I really enjoyed it.
I'll go ahead and jump in here and say this was my first exposure to Deep Space Nine ever. I still have never seen anything of Enterprise or, what's the other one too? Voyager? Is that right?
It's been a long time. You said the word.
I want to say something, but every time I say anything about Enterprise, I just get jumped on. So,
so watching this episode, I found I was trying to figure out what was going on in the larger context of the show, of the series at this time. And I don't necessarily feel like I needed to know that much in order to get the gist of the main story, but there's this compulsion in me, having watched all sorts of television, to just try and like understand, okay, what's going on with him having these visions? What are the mechanics behind this? And what was the loss of his friend that had such a triggering impact on this sort of flashback? And then I wasn't even aware that a lot of those other characters that he in the flashback are main characters from the show, except for that I saw Cole Meany, and I was like, okay, I know Cole Meany's on this show, I'm assuming the rest have to be. So it was fun kind of trying to figure out what it is, this world of Deep Space Nine and its mechanics and how they differentiate from what I'm already familiar with in Discovery and Picard. But beyond that, the story itself I found was really well executed, extremely poignant. Like always a pretty timeless episode for, you know, for it addressing very timely issues, I guess, in that regard. But it also was fascinating to me in its meta commentary, not just in this idea of who's the dream and who's the dreamer between the 1950s version and the 24th century. I'm guessing there for Trek. But also when you strip away both of those layers, what it means to be, the lead actor is Avery Brooks. Is that correct?
Yeah.
What it means to be him playing this role from the early aughts, time period, and how that character kind of resonates with him. So it just had these layers, and it was so well executed. And I'm glad we get to talk about it. I'm still mulling it over. It was a good way to trick me into watching Deep Space Nine when I've been so reticent.
This episode is very special to me. It might be my favorite episode of Trek of all time. I saw Far Beyond the Stars for the first time when I was a teenager, and I was just blown away by it. Like, my mind was ready to be shaped by this episode of Star Trek. It had such a huge, I had such a huge emotional reaction to it, and I do credit it, actually, because I saw it at such a young age with helping me recognize the reality of racial injustice and how systemic it is and how painful it is for millions of people. It's just a powerful episode in that respect, and it's also well acted and shot and just a sophisticated and powerful hour of television. You don't often get that in syndicated television in the 90s, and this show was syndicated. You know, it came on in my local channel, like they would run TNG, then they would run DS9. So you had to stay up late to watch this because it ran after the news and syndication. And I always stayed up late. And I was so happy that I stayed up late this night when I caught this one, because it was just out of nowhere. It was just powerful and poignant. And the idea that Star Trek would throw away the allegory and just tell this story straight up was just so new and surprising. They were really smart to ask Avery Brooks to direct this one, because not only was he like the right voice to lead the telling of the story, I think he's also an actor's director. Like Clyde was saying, he's very theatrical, but if you read about Avery Brooks, like, he teaches acting at his alma mater, and he is an actor's guy. So I think he really worked to get some great performances from his co-stars in this one. I think that really shines through. And they're all playing like new different characters in this episode. So you can tell they're all having a blast, and not being in the makeup, you know, probably helped a lot. Yeah. And that's another thing. I mean, this episode's special because for the first time, Star Trek just straight up dropped the pretense of allegory to tell a story about the deeply embedded issue of racial and societal injustice in our culture that has been present for as long as anyone can remember. I mean, this story was relevant in the 50s where it takes place. It was relevant in the 90s when it aired, and it's sadly still fucking relevant today. But yeah, there is no metaphor here. Like, Star Trek is always about the metaphor when it's doing its social allegories about, or social critiques of society. But this story takes place on Earth in the 50s, and the social commentary is all on the surface, plain as day. It's so powerful, and it encapsulates what I love about Trek so much. It's just an empathetic, socially aware story about the human condition that also happens to be super geeky. because it's about all these dorks and all these nerds writing sci-fi stories. It's perfect.
Well, Mike, this was interesting because I was talking to, you know, my wife about this and trying to explain this episode to her. And the thing I've always loved about Trek is, even though they talk in metaphors, it's like a thinly veiled metaphor, right? Like, they will often go down to some planet that is sexist or oppressive. Yeah. And even though it probably technically violates, you know, all of the Federation laws, they will liberate them anyway, right? And I was comparing it to kind of X-Men and the fact that X-Men is incredibly metaphor, right? Like, it's transposed. But like you said, this episode just stripped all that off and said, you know what? We're not even going to bother with that. We're just going to tell this story so that you are forced to see it, look at it straight on, and you're not going to miss any of the nuance.
Yeah.
And I thought it was great.
The writers, you know, all the writers on DS9, there was a great writer's room. And the leader, the showrunner, Ira Stephen Baer, was very socially aware for the time and was always wanting to make sure his show was responsible in that arena. And so was Avery Brooks. Avery Brooks was always very aware of showing a black father who's responsible with his son. You know, throughout the entire series, you get this beautiful story about Benjamin Sisko and Jake Sisko. And here, I think you mentioned this, Clyde, earlier, we have the actor who plays Ben's son, Jake Sisko, playing a different character who is headed down a tragic path, but you feel that father-son dynamic still. It's just, the whole series is just amazing. It's my favorite Star Trek. I wanted to talk real quick about the importance of the setting, since we're kind of talking about that. I think this episode wanted to tell a story directly, just directly about a black man's struggle. And that's why it had to take place on Earth and not in the 23rd or 24th century. Nerds, don't email me. Like, in space, in the future, for most intents and purposes, Sisko being a black man is a non-issue. Culture in Star Trek has evolved to the point where everyone accepts everyone for who they are. That's what I love about it. So to tell this story about a black man's ambitions and opportunities being crushed because of racism, like, they had to do this setting. And I think it was a smart move. It just worked so well. What did you guys think about the setting and how it came to life and why it was so relevant to tell this story?
Yeah, I think it was a smart choice in some ways, in that it's probably the time period I think a lot of their audience can probably automatically click into. It's like, oh, this was the past, right? Like, oh, we maybe don't have these problems anymore. And you know, this episode came out just a few years after the protests in Los Angeles, after the Rodney King case. And so I think it's important that they were essentially using this moment to be like, hey, we're going to set this in this time period, but it obviously still has repercussions and is essentially almost still doing a Trek thing, in that it's still like using another time or place to tell us a story, to give us the moral lesson, instead of having us to see something in contemporary 20th century at this point. Instead, we're going to set it in this other time period, but also to drive home the point that this is still happening, has still been happening. Here's how long this has been happening. Like, it has to stay at the front of your mind. And I was doing some reading about the production of this, and, you know, Avery Brooks was so hands-on with the full production of this episode. Like, all of the music choices are incredible. Like, if you listen to like the jazz that they're dancing to, it's like, it's all actually of time and of place and of that moment. And I think it really helps bring the whole story to life.
Yeah. In this era of Trek with the music is just kind of like wallpaper. Like, you don't really pay attention to it, but this episode throws that out the window, and it really, the score, the music really helps tell the story, unlike any other episode of DS9 or, you know, Star Trek.
I thought it was, it's interesting when you're talking about how racism's no longer a thing in Trek in the 24th century, but Sisko is having these these visions of the past and how they're resonating with how he's coping with things in the present, it seems like there's still this generational pain and kind of tracing back through the roots, his interaction with his father. It's still something that sticks with you, even as you move into this more utopian. I'm sure it's not completely ideal, right? Still in modern Trek timeline, but it's still these things, this past can't be fully escaped and has to be reckoned with and acknowledged to some degree.
Yeah, I love the setting of this 1950s kind of sci-fi magazine kind of room. And the reason why I loved it is because it still gave us a little taste of aspiration, right? Because if we can't be on a spaceship in a utopian environment, how cool would it be to be in a room full of people who love to write science fiction, right? And I think it was interesting to me as we kind of open in on that first kind of scene there, we see this collection of people that by and large look like and move around as though they don't necessarily agree on, you know, really very much, but they were committed to each other. And so we were still seeing some of those things there. And I thought that, wow, that there still is that promise. It just was, we were seeing that there were other forces there. And look, for those of us who watch Star Trek, we know that it's not all a utopian world, right? The thing about DS9 that was so interesting is that they had very clear cultural conflict, right? When you think about the Dominion and Cardassia and the and Bajor and who, what, you know, really from a war time colonization of who's the planet rightfully belonged to. So there's some very huge themes that go on in DS9. And so I think we were, it was nuanced in the way they gave it to us. So I thought the setting was really perfect. Because when we think about the 1950s, it is kind of, we're at this place where we're just about to get to the civil rights movement. Right, we're just about to get to some laws, and so the timing of what that meant, I thought, was absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, it's surprising because they deliberately set it in 1950s to tell this one specific story about this one guy that is representative of so many other people. Because DS9, like you said, it is very. The story of DS9 is very entrenched in themes of colonization, really themes of racism, really themes of oppression. All of those social issues come to the forefront at the very beginning to the very end of the show. So this story, it's impressive how they decided to really zero in on this specific story, because these themes are always in the show, but at the end of this, you know, this was towards the end of the series. They said, you know, we really need to tell a story about Black oppression and racism. How are we going to do that? Well, we've been doing it all along, because in metaphor they have. But, you know, they really zeroed in on this one with the setting and the characters.
Just briefly, while we were talking about the setting, I thought that placing it in that particular office, they do an interesting job of showing that it, for the time period, is a remarkably progressive collection of people. We have a man with socialist tendencies and a woman who's writing under a pseudonym of a man, and a Black man who's not presenting to the outward world as Black, as it's just a name on his writing. And they're all working together, but then, and you see that the other people are always proud and supportive of him. But near when it gets to the end, it's up to a point where he breaks, and it just feels like the other people don't know what to do, and they just kind of step away and watch him get taken away in a stretcher. Yeah. And I thought, I don't know, it's chilling, I guess is one way to put it. But also it was an important collection of people, I think, that they put in there specifically, because in a way it felt like it might potentially, and excuse me if I'm talking out my ass about what DS9 is, but it felt like maybe it's a little bit of a reflection of what Deep Space Nine, the station, is, in that it is this group of people from a bunch of different backgrounds that do try to band together against a lot of the problems of the outside space.
Yeah.
And they're all trying to fight that together in a way. Yeah. I don't know.
No, that's...
Yeah.
Yeah.
That works. Okay. That definitely works. Yeah, the other characters, like, just to bounce off that, like, the episode also gave us a nod to women's rights with the character of Kay Eaton, played by Nana Visitor, who typically plays Major Kira on the show, a Bajoran. She's typically a Bajoran, and she's part of the oppressed people who are just now escaping their oppression. And in this ep, she plays Kay Eaton, who had to write under the pseudonym of KC Hunter to hide her gender. So there's a nod to, you know, to the need for women's rights during this time. And I didn't look this up, but I'm pretty sure the character of KC Hunter is kind of modeled, or at least a small reference to, the real life Star Trek writer DC Fontana, who wrote on the original series and on Next Generation. So a lot of these characters, these writers' characters, are kind of based or riffs on actual sci-fi writers, and they're not all supportive of Benny. Like the Douglas character, the editor, played by Renee Aberjouan, who passed away recently. He, amazing actor. The guy who fires Benny at the end. I think with him, we see this picture of white indifference to racism and the plight and the history of the black people, just a complete indifference. And that kind of behavior and attitude is largely what keeps things from progressing for the better. And the show, this episode, makes that so clear with this character. Like, he's not portrayed as evil, just indifferent and going along with the shameful status quo and propping up that status quo. And that's, I love that it's portrayed as destructive, as it should be. Like in the beginning of the episode, he tells Benny not to be in the picture they're going to take for the marketing purposes, because that'll, you know, like, and he's like, it's nothing personal. It's just the way it is. And that just speaks to the truth of, like, a systemic racism in all aspects of our culture, even in, like, a dorky little sci-fi magazine.
Oh, I was just going to comment. I looked it up really quickly because I'm nice like that. No, Kay Eaton was inspired by Catherine Moore, who was a prominent female science fiction writer of the 1950s, who often collaborated with her husband, Henry Kuttner, and hid her gender behind the byline C.L. Moore.
Yeah. So. Yes. You know what? I did read about this like years ago, maybe when I was a teenager, so it's kind of fuzzy. But yeah, I think she would write stories and the husband would publish them because he would make more money off the stories, because they would obviously pay women less. It's ridiculous. Talking about, like, with Rene Aberjouan's character and how he, like, props up systemic racism by just propping up the status quo. I mean, this episode could have been really simple. Like, it was 1990, it was the mid to late 90s.
98, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It could have been really simple, like, where there's, like, an isolated issue where one or two characters are racist and they hurt someone due to their racist views and somebody gets hurt or whatever, but it actually depicts racism as systemic in a number of ways. Like, it's so deep. Like, we see how it unfolds with Benny's story and how he's limited by the culture that influences the publishing game because of racism, but also how he just can't make a living doing what he loves with his God-given talent. Like, he mentions he's been writing for 15 years and he still hasn't gotten to a place where he can really put food on the table and like buy a home for his wife and or his girlfriend. And his girlfriend is just trying to get him to quit and do something more practical because she sees that like their options are limited because of the system of systemic racism. It's so sad. She's like, just quit, come work at the diner for me. When the owner of the diner dies, like I'm sweet to him, so maybe he'll leave it to me and maybe we can have money. Like that, those were the options for these people. It was like being a sci-fi writer, that's just for white people.
I mean, those are still a lot of the views that we look at today. Like in the African-American community, you start talking about dreaming and your parents will look at you like you're absolutely crazy, right? And they value the stability, the sure thing. And so you will have discussions about, you know, what vocation you're going to have, right? So you look at, and the questions come down to, you know, and I think it's a very similar for like immigrant families as well. The question comes down to, well, how is this going to make you money, right? How are you going to make money with an English degree? Be a doctor, be a lawyer, right? Be an engineer, do something, get a trade, something that's going to make sure that you're safe. And so the idea of being a writer, even today, is still looked at as like, really? I mean, from a personal standpoint, I can't tell you how many people go, oh, you're a podcaster? Do you make any money from that? Why would you do that? So, because I love to talk about Star Trek. But yeah, so it's those themes are still, to your point, Mike, are still relevant today. You know, some 20 years plus after this episode aired.
Yeah, I saw online there's been a lot of discussion from, you know, Black TV writers who are just like, stop only staffing one of us in a writer's room. Like, we're not there to be the voice of all people of color and to hold all of your white guilt for you in this white writer's room. And, you know, we can talk about entertainment as a whole and how it's great to see these diverse casts. But I think it's also important for us to recognize that behind the camera is also equally important for diversity, because you get these important episodes like this when you have directors who are experienced with their life and how they're going to portray it on screen. You know, I think it even speaks volumes that like John Boyega, who is the plays Finn on Star Wars, the other star thing.
The Star Wars.
You got this. He, you know, was posting about how he's like, it's so important. I don't care if I ever get a job again. I'm going out to these marches. And it's like, what other, I've seen no white actors fear for their careers to go out and do anything involved with social justice movements, you know, or they just don't talk about it, period, because they have the privilege to be able to do that and it won't negatively impact their careers. So yeah, it's, I think we can talk as people who cover entertainment, it's also important, I think, to recognize the importance of supporting shows and franchises and lifting up and recommending people to do the work behind the camera in the writer's room, who are all only going to make the art that we enjoy even better.
You know, Mariah, to your point, it's interesting because on one hand, we see celebrities like Angelina Jolie or Brad Pitt or Madonna make these grand statements. In the African-American community, it is so often thought that we can be the performer, but we cannot have a voice outside of that realm. And the moment that you think that you can, right, then you're faced with Colin Kaepernick in the NFL, who spoke out, and never worked again, right? And, mm-hmm. you know, I always bring up the fact that that wasn't even his idea, right? We look at kneeling during the anthem. He asked a decorated Green Beret who played with him, who went to the University of Texas. He said, you know, I'm looking for a way to protest, you know, as someone who served, like, what do you think? And it was his idea. And Colin Kaepernick was ostracized for that. Mm-hmm. And so there's a, and that's a very recent example that have said, if you become more than anything but what you're supposed to be, this box that you've been placed on, the performer, it could cost you everything. And for a people who have been trying to build generational wealth and support their community and bring out their community, that is a threat that is very, very serious. And so when John Boyega steps out and says, you know, here I am, one of the lead faces of this franchise, and I'm willing to risk all of that because my voice needs to be heard on behalf of a voiceless people, that's significant. That is really significant. And so, I mean, it ties in with this episode in some way, because the writing room, the producers, they said, hey, we're gonna make this statement, and to hell with what you think about it. And though, you know, I don't think that they were ever really concerned about whether or not ratings were going to drop enough and people would boycott. But they said, hey, you know, there's probably some risk. And to Avery Brooks in particular, you know, I'm going to star in and direct this. And this is going to be my resume. Significant.
Yeah. Talking about celebrities who speak out about these things, we also see kind of a picture of that somewhat in this episode with Michael Dorn's character. He plays a celebrity baseball player who's accepted for his role as an entertainer and a great athlete, but he can't live in the white neighborhood. He says it plain as day because he will not be accepted there. And, you know, that just speaks to how this episode and how this writer's room was intent on talking about how much racism was such a systemic plague in all Black people's lives, in every walk, even with someone like this. It wasn't just about Benny. It was about all the Black people around him.
Yeah. And I think there is some really great pieces of dialogue that really talked about that in this episode. There are those moments where both the girlfriend character and the guy who's his son, but not his son in this particular instance, both essentially say, like, hey, you can keep dreaming about the future, but if you don't do something now, there is no that future. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was like a nice tie-in to the very end when he is like, am I the dream or am I the dreamer? And I think it's saying you have to be both. You have to like have the dream of this, of a Deep Space Nine station that is led by a Black captain. And then you also have to do the work to get to that dream in this current time.
You know, I'm reminded a little bit of the Watchmen production. I did a podcast, yes, on that show. Damon Lindelof.
The Damon Lindelof show.
Yeah, Damon Lindelof. I like that guy. When he was staffing the writer's room, he made it a point to, because he knew he was going to want to address a lot of topics that he alone should not address, in talking about power and race and gender. And he made sure it was over, the writer's room was over half female and over half minorities, and carried that through to the production crew as well, like the directors and so on. And it, in my opinion, it carried through in how complex the story was in addressing a lot of these aspects, instead of dumbing things down as some shows do, and just taking the shortcuts, making things simplified. And someone was asking me just earlier today, in fact, about like, oh, do you think Watchmen like holds up? And I'm like, even more so, I find it pretty poignant in this climate. Like the things they were saying about the problems of the police and the power structure and race and how we grapple with that.
This episode shows a lot of complexity, and I think some other Star Trek episodes do. Like, I was talking about the editor character played by Rene Abujamra, who props up the racist status quo. But on the flip side, we have Armin Shimerman's character, who usually plays Quark. So he's covered in all this makeup and these teeth and stuff. But fuck, that guy's such a good actor, because in this, he plays Douglas, who's like the liberal guy. And he tries to encourage Benny to write his story the way he wants to. And he intercedes on his behalf with the editor. Like, he's the character who is willing to stand up and defy the status quo. And that's an important character to have in this story, especially since the story, it's so great that the story, like, he's a white guy who's interceding on behalf of this suppressed black character who wants to get his art out there. But the story, it's such a credit to DS9 that the story never becomes about this white character. Like, this is not a white savior narrative at all. It's so great.
No green books here.
I think what was so fascinating to me about that is, so the Rene, and I always mess up his last name.
I think it's Abergenois.
Abergenois?
I think so.
Well, what's so fascinating about that is he does play the character who holds up the racist status quo, right? He's not going to buck the trend. But what's so wonderful is that he, the actor, was a key cast member on Benson, mm-hmm. which is historically one of the first, or I won't say first because there are a couple others, but an early show that was centered around a black lead, starring the incredible Robert Guillaume. So for them to play this character who played, I don't want to say sidekick or nemesis, but, you know, who played alongside this historical African-American kind of figure in television history, and then to cast him like this, I thought was genius, actually. And shows the skill of this cast. To your point, I in watching DS9, I was never really a fan of Quark. I always thought he was a little annoying. But Armin Shimerman killed it in this one. And like, I was really impressed with the cast from top to bottom in this. I think what they did, if nothing else, that's a hell of a demo reel to show what these actors were capable of. And it, wow.
Dude, very much. Like, Sarah Clofton, who typically plays Jake Sisko, the son of Benjamin Sisko, this is his best performance in the show, in my opinion. Like, he plays Jimmy. And, like, I'm sure this is what he puts on his reels to get jobs. Because they don't give Jake a lot in the main series. But in this episode, man, the character he plays is just so great and tragic. Like, he's never been better. And it's his story of the character is so tragic and striking and real. It's just so memorable. And this is me reading into it, but I'm pretty sure he and Avery Brooks and the other cast members read this script and realized this could be important. People might be talking about this one 20 years from now, so we're going to do a damn good job.
Yeah, and I know this episode is routinely put on like top 10 best episodes of Trek of all time, and it's always hailed as like one of the best episodes of DS9. And, I'm glad to see that it's had this legacy and that the brand of Star Trek continues to point and lift up this particular story that they've already told. And I'm glad that they use it as a jumping point to continue to tell these types of stories.
Yeah, very much.
I mean, this is definitely where I recognize I missed another whole layer of what this episode is. When you guys are talking about how particular characters in this show are playing either against type or amplifying certain character attributes, and it adds this other rich layer if you're already so familiar with this world. Because I had no clue that that kid was Jake, his son. So I missed any sort of context there. I thought it was just this sort of connection that they had, this relationship. He did have a care for him. But, I mean, certain elements like that, I'm like, okay, now it'd be more interesting to go and watch the rest of the show. This is how you tricked me. Wait a second.
It's on like three streaming services. It's right there for you. Mm-hmm. But I also want to talk about how this episode, we touched on it, but it's an ode to sci-fi fandom and sci-fi creators of color, like fans and creators of color, and how their voices, they were there. Their voices were there, but they were largely and just unjustly suppressed for decades, especially in the 50s. I mean, there was a huge lack of representation in sci-fi at the time, not that there isn't now, and a huge lack of Black voices telling these sci-fi stories, even though we did have some. But this episode never, like the other characters, when they find out Benny is writing a story about a Black captain, they talk about how that is more unbelievable than the fact that there are aliens from other worlds in his story. Like, that is such an indictment.
Yeah, just the level of, wow, of what rises to suspension of disbelief in that time period. And yeah, it's sad and poignant, like you said.
Do we want to talk about the breakdown scene?
Yeah, there are a couple of scenes that really stood out to me, and that's one of them for sure.
What were some of the scenes that stood out to you, Clyde?
So, the scene where he's walking back to the office and he's stopped by the two cops who are Cardassians.
Well, one of them's a Vorta, right?
I think so. So that was such a scene that spoke to me, because here he was, he's not doing anything. And then he just gets kind of accosted. And as I'm thinking about that, I'm reminded of this anxiety that I and many other African Americans just kind of always kind of live with, right? And it's in the simple things. So it's in the doing just little things. It's, for instance, I don't know about you, but me and my family are incredibly serious about making sure that we get our car inspected, like, in advance, right? Like the inspection sticker that goes on your car. Mm-hmm. There is so much anxiety and fear around that. Because if you don't, you are now opening yourself up to be needlessly pulled over by a cop. Right? For something that is pretty simple. And I've heard stories of people going, oh, it's not a big deal. You can get off with a warning. But for someone in the African-American community, you have no idea how that interaction is going to go. And so that scene reminded me of that, right? It reminded me of this, you know, we tell stories in the community about how you have to make sure that your children know how to interact with police officers very early, right? Like, it is not a time to joke or play games. It's very serious. And so in this, you saw that Benny was very serious. There was no joking. It was yes, sir, no, you know, may I have? Like, it was very, like, it was like uber polite. Because he was doing everything he could to make sure that interaction went well. And so that really stood out. And then you don't really see anything else after that, right? Like, it's not like he went away mad, or he went away and talked about it. He just kind of moved on. And I felt like that was truly indicative of what happens. You just, you're moving on to the next thing.
Right. It wasn't like a returning plot point where those guys come back. I mean, you see that they interact with Jake later. I think it's the same guy.
Well, yeah, and they're the ones who beat him right up at the end.
Yeah.
I thought that was a big one.
Yeah, that is so powerful. And you see those things. You realize this is part of Benny's everyday life. Uh-huh. And it really informs that breakdown scene at the end. Like, before that breakdown scene, the preacher character, who is played by Brock Peters, who is the actor who typically plays Sisko's father in DS9, I think more than once that preacher character appears to him and says that hope and despair walk arm in arm. And that theme is reflected so much in Benny's breakdown scene. The hope is that Benny has written the story, right? He's written the story. It exists. It's in his mind and it's real to him. And maybe one day it'll be real to other people as well. That story represents a piece of hope that Benny can hang on to. And then there's the despair when the story is denied publication and he's fired and he's suppressed. And with those themes in mind, the breakdown scene makes perfect sense to me, coming after everything we've seen in this episode, all the systemic daily racism he deals with. If you watch this episode for the first time, especially if you don't really watch DS9, there's a lot of Avery Brooksism in this. You know, you might think that maybe this breakdown scene goes on a little too long and maybe Brooks might be overacting it a little bit. But fuck, man, in today's context, I think it's played correctly and perfectly and powerful. And I believe Avery Brooks is probably truly channeling his true feelings of despair and frustration that he had. Like, the same type of shit we see going on today, the outpour of frustration that people have today, this episode, they mirror each other, mm-hmm. This breakdown scene and what we're seeing. I mean, in today's modern context, this scene feels so properly executed to me. And when Benny says he's tired of being calm in that moment, I mean, that is so well reflected in the protests we're seeing today, because in my view, like, Black people have been living with this injustice all their lives. And like Benny says, calm never got me a damn thing. Huh. So it's like those people who are decrying the broken windows and broken doors, that's not as important as someone's life. And, you know, like Benny says, calm never got them a goddamn thing. It took a week of protest and some riots breaking out in order for the other three cops to be charged in the murder of George Floyd. That's insane. That's insane. And yeah, when I think about that and I see Sisko's breakdown here, I'm like, that is right. And it's so powerful and resonant, and I tear up every damn time.
I saw something about when they were filming this particular scene, you know, because he was in it, the assistant director was, you know, behind camera for that time. And he apparently called cut, but he kept going. And he said if he hadn't really moved in to try to stop the scene, he would have gone on for like half an hour. Because that's
how
that moment he was.
He was gone. He was there. Yeah, he was that character.
You know, I was looking on Twitter, and a guy mentioned, he kind of posted that he once ran into Avery Brooks in a Harlem jazz dinner club. Hmm. And so he had a brief conversation with him, and he asked him, he said, you know, he just had to know. He said, what was it like to act in and direct this episode? And Avery Brooks just smiled at him and said, necessary. Yeah. I mean, he's a class act, and that showed in this scene. I mean, to me, everything in him came out. And, you know, what got me was, you know, to me, when I am a fan, I'm a fan of Broadway. So I love plays. I love musical theater. I love seeing it. And so I'm reminded of some great acting, things like A Raisin in the Sun. And if you ask me who my favorite actor is ever, I'll tell you it's Sidney Poitier. That's who he reminded me of in this scene, because it's the emotion, it's the subtleties. And what you got was, here is a man who you have, every step of the way, he has been nothing but poised. He looks the part, he moves the part, he speaks the part, right? And when you juxtapose him to even the other characters, whether it's Cassie or Jimmy or kind of Michael Dorn's baseball character, they all kind of move with this Harlem kind of musical flow, right? They look like they belong in Harlem. The vernacular that they use is very different, where Benny has assimilated. He dresses like he's supposed to. He moves and speaks like he's supposed to. But in this moment, his dream has been taken from him. His job has been taken from him. And he's being looked at it like, why are you being emotional? And he breaks. And in that, all of this emotion of who he is and what he's feeling comes out. And you just feel it. You feel that the dam has broken. And it's truly amazing. And I don't know if there's anybody else who could have done that but Avery Brooks.
I want to mention something else real quick. There's this... And I agree with you. Like, there's this beautiful video on StarTrek.com. I don't know if you guys have seen it, in which the editor of StarTrek.com, Kendra James, talks about how DS9 and particularly the character of Benjamin Sisko and Avery Brooks inspired her throughout her life. Like, she's young. She's maybe like not even 30. Sisko inspired her so much that she attended the same college that Avery Brooks attended, and she got to meet him when he came back to the school for an event. And she got to tell him that seeing him on screen playing a black leader and a loving, responsible father to Jake was extremely important to her. And, well, she said, that was so important to me and it inspired me. And he looked at her and said, that's why I did it. I did it for you, so you could watch it. And during the event, they were interviewing him, and he said he took the role of Sisko because he wanted all kids, especially black kids, to be able to see themselves in this popular franchise. He understood the value of representation in the early 90s. He wanted them to see a black hero who had a young black son and somebody who they made action figures out of, because he saw that as just so important to our mass culture. Like, Avery Brooks was dialed in, man. And Kendra's story proves him right. Like, it's a touching video. Check it out, StarTrek.com. I'll link to it in the show notes for this episode. But just hearing her talk about how Avery Brooks and the character of Sisko inspired her was just beautiful. It really touched me this week.
Yeah, I watched that video too. I thought it was really a really great video, and I love seeing her being in charge of sort of the articles and the fandom that's happening on that website now. And
there's some good shit on there now.
There's some really good stuff. Yeah. She's doing an excellent job, and I'm so glad that she had that inspiration and made it through Oberlin College and came out the other side. Now our wonderful geek editor empress.
Yeah, for sure. I want to talk about the idea of the dreamer and the dream. Mariah, you touched on it earlier, and I would love to hear all your thoughts on what that means and what the context of it is in this episode. This is the priest character calls Benny the dreamer and the dream, which to me, partly, I think it's, well, first, I did look this up, and it is documented as that theme and that line being influenced by Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. And to me, it reminds us that dreamers like Benny, even though they're unjustly weighed down and suppressed by racism in all its forms, they can eventually help in their own way to change things with their art and their imagination, because it defies those social limitations of the time. So in this story, it's a little convoluted, but the connection, like I think, Grant, earlier you expressed how you like the meta-ness of this episode. Like the connection between Benny, the dreamer, and Cisco, the dream, and Avery Brooks himself. It's just also poetic. Like when we get back to DS9, the station at the end of this episode after the 1950s portion is over, and I think we see Cisco look in the mirror and he sees his reflection again as Benny. And it's a great, powerful metatextual moment where I think the show wants you to wonder, did Benny's dream come true? Is the show I'm watching supposed to be truly based on this character in the lineage of Star Trek? Was it really about Benny Russell writing these characters? And that idea takes on extra weight when you research more about the character of Benny Russell. And Ira Stephen Baer, the showrunner of DS9, says, yeah, you know what? I wrote the final episode of DS9, and I wrote the final scene originally that the camera pans back and you see the sets being taken down. You see the cast walk off and you see Avery Brooks playing an elderly Benny Russell sitting in a director's chair watching his work become a television show.
Whoa, for real?
And breaking down and crying. And that's how I wanted to end the series. But, you know, even though everyone on staff loved it and thought it was powerful, it would break Star Trek canon. So Paramount/CBS nixed it. But isn't that amazing? Isn't that powerful?
They should have shot that. Today, you have to shoot that.
Yeah.
Just for the web, right?
Just for the DVD, the Blu-ray, the web, something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In 98, we didn't know about...
Yeah, bonus features, like... alt endings?
Yeah, no, there was no alt endings in 98. Oh, man. That would have been amazing.
Imagine, I'll take that over the Snyder Cut any day.
Okay, really? Can you imagine if that was something that leaked out at any point in the last, say, like 5 or 10 years? That would have been amazing.
Yeah. What did you guys think about, how did that hit you, the idea of the dreamer and the dream?
Yeah, I think it was one of my favorite lines. I think it was just the reminder that there has to be an action for a dream to come true. You know, we don't have... this isn't a Disney production. We don't have magical fairies and fairy godmothers who are going to go make things happen for us. And I also read that it was based on the "I Have a Dream" speech. And I think it's important to also remember another speech that Dr. King gave was about the perils of optimism. And I always think about that and how, while yes, it is so important to think about an optimistic future, like a future like the 24th century Star Trek, but without action, that optimism is null and void. You know, we can't continue to look at things through, you know, rose-colored glasses. We have to remember that actions always speak louder than words, and that's how you actually change things. And so I thought it was a smart nod to a reference obviously a lot of people were going to get, right? Everyone knows that speech. It's one of the only things they teach you about civil rights in public school. And so it's an easy touch point for people to start thinking about that. But in my mind, I like to think of it as a reminder that you have to be the dreamer in order for the dream to be accomplished. And dreaming is not just enough. There has to be action with it as well.
Right.
One of the things I keep wondering, though, about the idea of Benny being the dream, it's easier, at least for me, to read the story as Benny dreaming of the possibilities of the future. But what is it for us to read into it in the flip of what it means for Cisco to be dreaming back to the past of Benny? And what does it mean for Benny to be that dream of Cisco's? Is it strictly in the sense of the plot device, or were they going for something else a little bit more nuanced? I guess I want to ask you guys that.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point too, Grant, like to think about it as, you know, the also being someone who has not watched a lot of DS9. I took it in the contemporary sense of he's going through a trauma of losing a friend, losing a crew, losing this ship. And maybe his trauma response is to go back to a time in this vision that he's going to have about someone also going through a trauma. And so it's like, if his brain is going to process this event in this particular way, this is the creative way his brain has decided to sort of let him go through these emotions and to do it through this story.
That inherited trauma just bubbles up. Yeah.
Like, does this element of the story bleed over from the previous episode and into the following episode at all, as far as Sisko's journey and how he's kind of grappling with loss? Because I know, like, we watch a lot of these shows, a lot of shows in general, but like Trek, I think it's we frequently see these side characters die, and not seeing these kind of moments of pause, moments of grief, or they're given really briefly. And here it seems like they're dedicating a full episode to him working it out through this other dream sequence. And I was just kind of curious if that plays out elsewhere.
Yeah, that's what DS9 was interested in telling those human stories. And it was the first Star Trek to be truly serialized. It wasn't just episode of the week. So what happens in one episode does reverberate on and on and on and on. So we definitely do get stories of Sisko mourning people. And especially since the context of this episode, it takes place during an arc in which the Federation is at war, one of the most destructive wars it's ever had. And Sisko is on the front lines and he's dealing with loss every day. And this one just happened to hit him so hard. It was his breaking point. This is all a part of one long story. And it does make sense within the context of DS9.
I think for me, this concept of dreamer and the dream is probably a little bit more straightforward from the way I see it. As I look at it through my lens, I am the dreamer and the dream, right? So I'm a dream realized by my forefathers, and I'm dreaming of a tomorrow that's yet to come. And so when I think back, like, my grandmother was born on a cotton plantation in deep South Mississippi, mm-hmm. right? My great-grandfather was a sharecropper. Their dream and all the things that they did, to Mariah's point, it wasn't just about a dream, like, oh, wishful thinking, right? That's not what it was. It was a dream that they pursued, right? And that dream, the decisions that they made, the sacrifices that they made, the hardships that they endured, was for a dream that someday they would have someone in their lineage who would do the things that I am doing today, right? And likewise, I look and think about not just my children, but when I think of what might my children's children accomplish and the world that they may live in, the dream is that it'll be better, right? So for Benny to be able to dream, right? So in some regards, the fact that you have this black man who is a published science fiction writer is no small feat, right? Right, at a time where the mere fact that he could write and read to generations before him was something that they would have a hard time dreaming up themselves. So he was a dream realized, and yet he's dreaming so far in the future of a concept that no one around him can even fathom. Right, that it's such a dream. And therefore, we look back and then we look at Benjamin Sisko and we say he is a dream realized. But this wasn't thought of at the time, but if you look forward and go, what must that be like to then dream of someone like a Michael Burnham, right? Even though technically it's in the past, right? Well, right now it's in the future. So, but thinking about that, and so to me, it is at any one point, any of us, we are the dream realized and dreaming of the next one.
Thank you. That's perfect.
Right on. Yeah, that's spot on. Thank you. I want to talk about how just Avery Brooks was a great shepherd of his character on DS9. Like, I know that the writers responded to how he influenced the writing of the character, because he was always making sure that Sisko knew his history and talked about it, and that the character would call out questionable things on the show. Like, there's this episode called Bada Bing Bada Bang. It's like this goofy Holosuite episode where the entire crew, they invite Sisko to a popular Holosuite program on the station, which is a recreation of a 1960s Las Vegas nightclub. So it's all like, you know. And at first he doesn't want to go, because he says, and this is a small part of the episode, like, he doesn't want to go because he says the program is a false representation that denies the reality of the setting, because he would not be welcome in such a place in the early 60s. He's like, fuck that, it's bullshit. But he eventually does take part in the program because he realizes that he chooses to allow it to represent the idea that Black people are no longer under the heel of those terrible limitations in his reality. And like, that plot point sounds like it should be the whole episode, but it's really just one little scene in that episode. The rest is just like 1960s Las Vegas shenanigans. But his struggle with that nightclub program is so memorable, and it's amazing that it's in there. And I, you know, I'm sure I read this somewhere. It's because Avery Brooks said, we should put this in there. So he was always a shepherd of this character and making sure that these themes were addressed.
Mike, you're convincing me to go back and watch DS9 now.
Everybody needs to watch DS9.
And I've seen it. Like, I'm going to go back and watch it again.
Yeah. It's the most calming most calming Star Trek for me. Like, it just has this chill pace. Like, I love it. I have more stuff to say, guys, but I know I want to ask you, like, is there anything else that you specifically want to point out about this episode, about Trek in general, when we're talking about these issues?
Oh, man. I just think for a long time in Trek and in a lot of entertainment, it's easy to find escapism, but it's also important to recognize the privilege of escapism. And I appreciate the balance that this series often brings to it. But yeah, I'm so glad I'm on this show with y'all, and that we can talk about all of these things and not just go surface level of entertainment. So I really appreciate that. And yeah, I'm so glad we are hopefully going to get Discovery soon, and we're going to
fingers crossed
and be able to talk about, the amazing portrayal of Michael Burnham and how important that is. And, you know, I think Clyde really brought it home talking about, you know, the importance of representation and the video that you mentioned, Mike. But it's true. It's there. Like, I still cry watching Wonder Woman. I still cry watching the Lady Ghostbusters. I sometimes still cry when I watch Janeway. So it's like, you know, those moments where you can actually see yourself on screen are so important, and I'm glad Trek has been doing that for so many people for such a long time.
I mean, you mentioned that. I mean, Sisko, he's the evolution. I mean, you talk about the dream and the dreamer. I mean, from Uhura to Geordi, right? Now we've got a Black engineer, right? Which, as we all know, that's like one of the coolest jobs on the entire show. Like, this is the guy who's got to save your butt like every week, right? And then to the guy who's running the space station. I mean, you talk about dream and dreamer, that representation, that matters. I mean, if, you know, I'm going to get my Black card taken away for telling secrets, but The truth of the matter is, I think you'd be hard-pressed to find many African-Americans who are in their, we'll say, late 30s to mid-40s who went to college and won't tell you that the TV show A Different World had a huge impact on them, right? Because it's these things where you can see, you can visualize yourself in a way that you haven't been before. And that is why this show, this series, means so much to me, because you can visualize not just yourself, but you can visualize a world that is better, right? It's not perfect, but it's better. The greed, the hatred, the discrimination, it's like if that would just go away, we could deal with some stuff that actually probably really matters. And so, yeah, so that representation, that seeing Cisco, that's, you know, Mike, you've mentioned it a couple times, the importance of having that, having in 98, the importance of having a black father who was raising his son. I can't underscore how important that was.
Yeah.
Like this show did so many things that probably go unnoticed, but made a big difference.
Yeah. I also want to mention real quick, like with DS9, there's also the epic two-parter Past Tense, which takes place in the late 20th century, I believe, and it's all about racial and social indifference. And there are tons of other episodes which tackle these subjects in smart and powerful ways. This show was all about that. It pushed the boundaries of what Star Trek could be, and it often did it very successfully. So I highly recommend it. There's a reason it's my favorite Trek. Yeah, just kind of to wrap it up, Star Trek has a long history, obviously, of telling stories about unity, about progressive social values, about tolerance, about anti-racism. Like you mentioned, Clyde, Uhura, Nichelle Nichols, says that she was, this is a beautiful story. She considered quitting Star Trek TOS early on, but Martin Luther King Jr. contacted her and persuaded her to continue in the role because he empathized the impact that she was having as a black woman seen every week in that prominent position on the ship. And Star Trek created history, obviously, in 1968, when it showed the first interracial kiss on TV between Kirk and Uhura in Plato's Stepchildren. So, and Spock is essentially a biracial character who deals with those issues. You know, it's allegory, but yeah. I mentioned Past Tense, the DS9 two-parter. That one at times is almost as powerful as Far Beyond the Stars. It's really good. We have Stamets and Culber's relationship on Discovery. It's a queer relationship that is handled with care, with grace. There's like, maybe you guys have episodes that you know you might want to recommend. I want to recommend the TNG episode, The Enemy, where Geordi has to work with a Romulan. And that's the Federation's enemy at the time. And so they hate each other, but they find common ground because they're both really scared at the time. And they realize they're very similar. And even though they're supposed to hate each other, they become compatriots and friends and they help each other. So there's more allegory there. Tons of great episodes of Star Trek. I can recommend more unless you guys want to recommend some.
I would recommend TNG episode Darmok, season 5, episode 2, where Picard is stranded on a planet with an alien who does not speak his language. Like, how they learn to communicate and help each other is, I think, significant in terms of how we can kind of work with one another.
Yeah, there's that TOS one where they have their faces painted black and white, and
yeah,
they want to kill the other guy.
They've never, opposite. You know,
that's a little on the nose, but it's still there. It's good.
You know? The heavy-handedness is yeah, there from time to time.
Yeah. Anything else you guys want to say before we run out?
No, I just say thank you for y'all. I know this is a longer episode than we normally do, so thank you for getting to the end. I hope you enjoyed this conversation. And just an additional reminder to go to donate.startrekpod.co to help us make a nice big old donation at the end of the month.
Yeah, thank you guys for joining us on Star Trek Discovery Pod. We'll be back hopefully next week live. And remember to visit StarTrekPod.co to subscribe on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, wherever you get podcasts. Clyde, Grant, Mariah, I want to thank you so much for you know, taking the extra time to watch this episode, to research it, for taking the extra time tonight to go a little longer for this conversation. It really means a lot to me. I super appreciate it.
Yeah, I just, I want to say I appreciate all of you for being open enough to have the conversation. And our community who said, hey, we want you guys to talk about this. So that's incredible. I think if you've made it to the end of this episode and you have found that this has been helpful or enlightening or fun or weird or whatever, and you want to share it, please share the episode. Tell other people who you think might learn something or grow. So I encourage you to tweet out kind of at Star Trek Pod. Let people know about what we've been talking about.
And yeah, I'd like to go ahead and also jump on that to say we did get a positive response from people on Patreon to this idea. You guys can become patrons if you want, if you like what you're hearing, over at patreon.com/StarTrekPod. And we really value the people that have taken, I mean, we value all of you guys listening to us, but we really appreciate that that the people that have contributed to our show to continue the growth of this podcast venture, that we can openly talk with them over on the private Slack channel about these kind of things and get their feedback on what they'd be interested in hearing. And they did encourage us to have this conversation, and they are very supportive. We appreciate all of you guys for the support that you've given us thus far. We're going to continue to try and make great weekly content on the main podcast, but we also do bonus exclusive stuff for our patrons, including Badass Women of Trek, which Mike and Mariah have been continuing on their adventures. And I think someday we're going to get into watching some Kelvinverse movies and discussing those, because I think that's like the only bit of Star Trek I'm still familiar with or I was familiar with prior to this. And so once again, I want to thank you guys who have listened to this episode, been so supportive of us already over on Patreon, and encourage everyone else, if you'd want to come join us over there, it's patreon.com/StarTrekPod. If you make a $2 an episode pledge, you get access to that Slack channel, and we'd love to see you there and chat with you.
Yeah, I want to add to that, Grant. Doing this pod for me was not an easy decision. It's been an emotionally exhausting week and a half. And if I'm honest, if it wasn't for the conversation and support on the Patreon, from our patrons on the Slack channel, I probably wouldn't have done it. But after hearing that, I felt like I really wanted to be a part of this discussion. So it's important, and we're listening to you guys.
Yeah. Thanks for being here, Clyde.
Thank you, Clyde.
Hey, where can we follow you online, Clyde, and hear more from you?
You can follow me along. Follow me online at Twitter at Clyde Haynes, or on the web, keyandclyde.com. That's KEI and Clyde.com.
Mariah.
And I'm at Mariah Gossett on all social. That's Mariah with a Y and a Gossett with two S's and two T's.
Grant Davis.
At Baron Von Grant. I'm stuck with that screen name.
It's a good one.
I guess.
BVG. Before we go, I want to shout out Karen, who helps run our Twitter, and James Worm, who helps run our Insta. Thank you, guys.
Yay, Karen. Yay, James.
Thank you. You can follow me on Twitter at Mike Moody. I'm 50 followers away from 1,000. Come on, people.
Ooh.
Nice.
Humble brag.
Again, guys, thanks for this conversation. This, you know, conversations like this are just the start of what we need to do. So keep that in mind and live long and prosper.